God's Gods by Terry Pratchett. Part 6. Carrot looked around him. Shelves stretched away in every direction. On those shelves, books. He made a calculated guess. "This is a library, isn't it?" he said. The librarian maintained his gentle but firm grip on the boy's hand and led him along the maze of aisles. "Is there a body?" said Carrot. "There'd have to be. Worse than murder. A body in a library. It could lead to anything." The ape eventually padded to a halt in front of the shelf no different than it seemed 100 others. Some of the books were chained up. There was a gap. The librarian pointed to it.
"Look!"
"Well, what about it? A hole where a book should be."
"Look!"
"A book has been taken." "A book has been taken. You summoned the watch," Carrot drew himself up proudly, "because someone's taken a book. You think that's worse than murder?" The librarian gave him the kind of look other people would reserve for people who said things like, "What's so bad about genocide?" "This is practically a criminal offence, wasting watch time," said Carrot. "Why don't you just tell the head wizards or whoever they are?"
"Look!"
The librarian indicated with some surprisingly economical gestures that most wizards would not find their own bottoms with both hands. "Well, I don't see what we can do about it," said Carrot. "What's the book called?" The librarian scratched his head. This one was going to be tricky. He faced Carrot, put his leather-gloved hands together, and folded them open. "I know it's a book. What's its name?" The librarian sighed and held up a hand. 4 words, said Carrot. 1st word. The ape pinched 2 wrinkled fingers together. "Small word. A, the, for,
look!
The, the. 2nd word. 3rd word? Small word. The, a, to, of, for, of. The something of something. 2nd word. What? Oh, 1st syllable. Fingers? Touching your fingers? Thumbs?" The orangutan growled and tugged theatrically at one large hairy ear. "Oh, sounds like. Fingers, hand, adding up? Sums? Cut off. Smaller word, some. 2nd syllable. Small. Very small syllable. A, in, un, on. Some, on, some, on. Summon. Summoner. Summoning. Summoning. The summoning of something. This is fun, isn't it? 4th word. Whole word." He peered intently as the librarian gyrated mysteriously. "Big thing. Huge big thing. Flapping. Great big flapping leaping thing. Teeth. Huffing. Blowing. Great big huge blowing flapping thing." Sweat broke out on Carrot's forehead as he tried obediently to understand. "Sucking fingers. Sucking fingers thing. Burnt. Hot. Great big hot blowing flapping thing." The librarian rolled his eyes. "Homo sapiens. You could keep it." The great dragon danced and spun and trod the air over the city. Its colour was moonlight gleaming off its scales. Sometimes it would twist and glide with a deceptive speed over the rooftops for the sheer joy of existing. And it was all wrong, Vimes thought. Part of him was marvelling at the sheer beauty of the sight, but an insistent, weaselly little group of brain cells from the wrong side of the synapsis was scrawling its graffiti on the walls of wonderment. "It's a bloody great lizard," they jeered. "Must weigh tons. Nothing that big can fly, not even on beautiful wings. And what is a flying lizard doing with great big scales on its back?" 500 feet above him, a lance of blue-white flame roared into the sky. "It can't do something like that. It'd burn its own lips off." Beside him, Lady Ramkin stood with her mouth open. Behind her, the little caged dragons yammered and howled. The great beast turned in the air and swooped over the rooftops. The flame darted out again. Below it, yellow flames sprang up. It was done so quietly and stylishly that it took Vimes several seconds to realise that several buildings had in fact been set on fire.
"Golly," said Lady Ramkin. "Look, it's using the thermals. That's what the fire is for."
She turned to Vimes, her eyes hopelessly aglow.
Do you realise we're very probably seeing something that no one has seen for centuries?
Yes, it's a bloody flying alligator setting fire to my city, shouted Rhymes.
She wasn't listening to him. There must be a breeding colony somewhere, she said. After all this time, where do you think it lives?
Rhymes didn't know, but he swore to himself that he would find out and ask it some very serious questions.
One egg, breathed the breeder. Just let me get my hands on one egg.
Rhymes stared at her in genuine astonishment. It dawned on him that he was very probably a flawed character. Below them, another building exploded into flame. How far exactly, he said, speaking very slowly and very carefully, as if to a child, did these things fly?
They're very territorial animals, murmured her ladyship. According to legend, they...
Vimes realised he was in for another dose of dragon lore. Just give me the facts, m'lady, he said impatiently.
Not very far, really, she said, slightly taken aback.
Thank you very much, ma'am. You've been very helpful, muttered Vimes, and broke into a run. Somewhere in the city. There was nothing outside for miles except low fields and swamp. It had to be living somewhere in the city. His sandals flopped on the cobbles as he hurtled down the streets. Somewhere in the city. Which was totally ridiculous, of course. Totally ridiculous and impossible. He didn't deserve this. Of all the cities in all the world it could have flown into, he thought. It's flown into mine. By the time he reached the river, the dragon had vanished. But a pall of smoke was hanging over the streets and several human bucket chains had been formed to pass lumps of the river to the stricken buildings. The job was considerably hampered by the droves of people streaming out of the streets, carrying their possessions. Most of the city was wood and thatch, and they weren't taking any chances. In fact, the danger was surprisingly small. Mysteriously small, when you came to think about it. Vimes had surreptitiously taken to carrying a notebook these days, and he had noted the damage as if the mere act of writing it down somehow made the world a more understandable place. Item, a coach house. Belonging to an inoffensive businessman who'd seen his new carriage go up in flames. Item, a small vegetable shop with pinpoint accuracy. Vimes wondered about that. He'd bought some apples in there once, and there didn't appear to be anything about it that a dragon could possibly take offence at. Still, very considerate of the dragon, he thought, as he made his way to the watch-house. When you think of all the timber yards, hayricks, thatched roofs and oil stores it could have hit by chance... It's managed to really frighten everyone without actually harming the city. Rays of early morning sunlight were piercing the drifts of smoke as he pushed open the door. This was home. Not the bare little room over the candlemaker's shop in Wixon's Alley where he slept, but this nasty brown room that smelled of unswept chimneys, Sergeant Colon's pipe, Nobby's mysterious personal problem, and latterly, Carrot's armour polish. It was almost like home. No one else was there. He wasn't entirely surprised. He clumped up to his office and leaned back in his chair, whose cushion would have been thrown out of its basket in disgust by an incontinent dog, pulled his helmet over his eyes, and tried to think. No good rushing about. The dragon had vanished in all the smoke and confusion as suddenly as it had come. Time for rushing about soon enough. The important thing was working out where to rush to. He'd been right, wading bird. But where did you start looking for a bloody great dragon in a city of a million people? He was aware that his right hand, entirely unbidden, had pulled open the bottom drawer, and three of his fingers, acting on sealed orders from his hindbrain, had lifted out a bottle. It was one of those bottles that emptied themselves. Reason told him that sometimes he must occasionally start one, break the seal, see the amber liquid glistening all the way up to the neck. It was just that he couldn't remember the sensation. It was as if the bottles arrived two-thirds empty. He stared at the label. It seemed to be Jimkin Bearhugger's old selected dragon's blood whiskey. Cheap and powerful. You could light fires with it. You could clean spoons. You didn't have to drink much of it to be drunk, which was just as well. It was Nobby who shook him awake with the news that there was a dragon in the city, and also that Sergeant Colon had had a nasty turn. Vimes sat and blinked owlishly while the words washed around him. Apparently having a fire-breathing lizard focusing interestedly on one's nether regions from a distance of a few feet can upset the strongest constitution. An experience like that could leave a lasting mark on a person. Vimes was still digesting this when Carrot turned up with the librarian swinging along behind him.
"Did you see it? Did you see it?" he said.
"We all saw it," said Vimes.
"I know all about it," said Carrot triumphantly. "Someone brought it here with magic. Someone's stolen a book out of the library, and guess what it's called?"
"Can't even begin to," said Vimes weakly.
"It's called The Summoning of Dragons."
"Look!"
confirmed the librarian.
"Oh, what's it about?" said Vimes. The librarian rolled its eyes.
"It's about how to summon dragons, by magic."
"Look!"
"And that's illegal, that is," said Carrot happily. "Releasing feral creatures upon the streets, contrary to the wild animals, public—"
Vimes groaned. That meant wizards. You got nothing but trouble with wizards.
"I suppose," he said, "there wouldn't be another copy of this book around, would there?"
"Look!"
The librarian shook his head.
"And you wouldn't happen to know what's in it?" Vimes sighed.
"What? Oh, four words," he said wearily.
"First word, sounds like, bend. Bow. Sow, cow, how. Second word, small word, to.
Yes, understood, but I meant in any kind of detail."
"No. I see.
What are we going to do now, sir?" said Carrot anxiously.
"It's out there," intoned Nobby, "gone to ground like during the hours of daylight, coiled up in its secret lair on top of a great hoard of gold, dreaming ancient reptilian dreams from a dawn of time, waiting for the secret curtains of the night, when once more it will sally forth."
He hesitated, and added sullenly,
"What are you all looking at me like that for?"
"Very poetic," said Carrot.
"Well, everyone knows the real old dragons used to sleep on a hoard of gold," said Nobby. "Well-known folk myth."
Vimes looked blankly into the immediate future.
Vile though Nobby was, he was also a good indication of what was going through the mind of the average citizen. You could use him as a sort of lab rat to forecast what was going to happen next.
"I expect you'd be really interested in finding out where that hoard is, wouldn't you?" said Vimes experimentally.
Nobby looked even more shifty than usual.
"Well, Captain, I was thinking of having a bit of a look around, you know. When I'm off duty, of course," he added virtuously.
"Oh dear," said Captain Vimes.
He lifted up the empty bottle, and with great care put it back in the drawer. The Elucidated Brethren were nervous. A kind of fear crackled from brother to brother. It was the fear of someone who, having cheerfully experimented with pouring the powder and wadding the ball, has found that pulling the trigger had led to a god-awful bang, and pretty soon someone is bound to come and see who's making all the noise. The Supreme Grand Master knew that he had them, though. Sheep and lamb, sheep and lamb. Since they couldn't do anything much worse than they had already done, they might as well press on and damn the world, and pretend they'd wanted it like this all along. Oh, the joy of it! Only Brother Plasterer was actually happy.
"Let that be a lesson to all oppressive vegetable sellers," he kept saying.
"Yes, said Brother Doorkeeper. "Only the thing is, there's no chance of us sort of accidentally summoning the dragon here, is there?"
"Aye, that is, we have it under perfect control," said the Supreme Grand Master smoothly. "The power is ours, I can assure you."
The brothers cheered up a little bit.
"And now," the Supreme Grand Master continued, "there is the matter of the king."
The brothers looked solemn, except for Brother Plasterer.
"Have we found him, then?" he said. "That's a stroke of luck."
"You never listen, do you?" snapped Brother Watchtower. "It was all explained last week. We don't go finding anyone, we make a king."
"I thought he was supposed to turn up, 'cause of destiny."
Brother Watchtower sniggered.
"We sort of helped destiny along a bit."
The Supreme Grand Master smiled in the depths of his robe. It was amazing, this mystic business. You tell them a lie, and then when you don't need it any more, you tell them another lie, and tell them they're progressing along the road to wisdom. Then, instead of laughing, they follow you even more, hoping that at the heart of all the lies they'll find the truth. And bit by bit, they accept the unacceptable. Amazing.
"Bloody hell, that's clever," said Brother Doorkeeper.
"How do we do that, then?"
"Look, the Supreme Grand Master said what we do. We find some handsome lad who's good at taking orders. He kills the dragon, and Bob's your uncle, simple.
much more intelligent than waiting for a so-called real king.
But... Brother Plasterer seemed deep in the toils of cerebration. If we control the dragon, and we do control the dragon, right, then we don't need anyone killing it. We just stop summoning it, and everyone will be happy, right?
Oh, yes, said Brother Watchtower nastily. I can see it, can you? We just trot out and say hello. We won't set fire to your houses any more, aren't we nice, do we? The old point about the thing with the king is that it'll be sort of a
undeniably potent and romantic symbol of absolute authority, said the Supreme Grand Master smoothly.
That's it, said Brother Watchtower. A potent authority.
Oh, I see, said Brother Plasterer. Right, okay. That's what the king will be.
That's it, said Brother Watchtower.
No one's going to argue with the potent authority, are they?
Too right, said Brother Watchtower.
Stroke of luck, then, finding the true king right now, said Brother Plasterer. 1,000,000 to 1 chance, really.
We haven't found the right king. We don't need the right king, said the Supreme Grand Master wearily. For the last time, I have just found us a likely lad who looks good in a crown and can take orders, and knows how to flourish a sword. Now just listen.
Flourishing, of course, was important. It didn't have much to do with wielding. Wielding a sword, the Supreme Grand Master considered, was simply the messy business of dynastic surgery. It was just a matter of thrust and cut. Whereas a king had to flourish one. It had to catch the light in just the right way, leaving the watchers in no doubt that here was destiny's chosen. He'd taken a long time preparing the sword and shield. It had been very expensive. The shield shone like a dollar in a sweep's ear hole. But the sword was magnificent. It was long and shiny. It looked like something some genius of metalwork, one of those little Zen guys who works only by the light of dawn, and can beat a club sandwich of folded steels into something with the cutting edge of a scalpel, and the stomping power of a sex-crazed rhinoceros on bad acid, had made, and then retired in tears because he'd never, ever do anything so good again. There were so many jewels on the hilt, it had to be sheathed in velvet. You had to look at it through smoked glass. Just laying a hand on it practically conferred kingship. As for the lad, he was a distant cousin, keen and vain and stupid in a passably aristocratic way. Currently, he was under guard in a distant farmhouse with an adequate supply of drink and several young ladies, although what the boy seemed most interested in was mirrors. Probably hero material, the Supreme Grand Master thought glumly.
I suppose, said Brother Watchtower, that he isn't the real heir to the throne.
What do you mean? Said the Supreme Grand Master.
Well, you know how it is. Fate plays funny tricks.
It would be a laugh, wouldn't it? Said Brother Watchtower, if this lad turned out to be the real king, after all this trouble.
There is no real king any more, snapped the Supreme Grand Master.
What do you expect? Some people wandering in the wilderness for hundreds and hundreds of years? Patiently handing down a sword and birthmark? Some sort of magic?
He spat the word. He'd make use of magic. Means to an end, end justifies the means, and so forth. But to go around believing in it, believing it had some sort of moral force, like logic, made him wince.
Good grief, man, be logical, be rational! Even if any of the old royal family survived, the bloodline would be so watered down by now there must be thousands of people who lay claim to the throne. Even, he tried to think of the least likely claimant, even someone like Brother Dunnikin.
He stared at the assembled brethren.
Don't see him here tonight, by the way.
Funny thing, that, said Brother Watchtower thoughtfully. Didn't you hear?
What?
He got bitten by a crocodile on his way home last night, poor little bugger.
What?
1,000,000 to 1 chance. It had escaped from a menagerie or something, and was lying low in his backyard. He went to feel under his doormat for his doorkey, and it had him by the fumes.
Brother Watchtower fumbled under his robe, produced a grubby brown envelope.
We're having a whip round to buy him some grapes and that. I don't know whether you'd like to,
Put me down for $3, said the Supreme Grand Master.
Brother Watchtower nodded.
Funny thing, he said. I already have.
Just a few more nights, thought the Supreme Grand Master. By tomorrow, the people would be so desperate they'd crown even a one-legged troll if he'd get rid of the dragon. And we'll have a king, and he'll have an adviser, a trusted man, of course, a and the stupid rabble can go back to the gutter. No more dressing up, no more ritual, no more summoning the dragon. I can give it up, he thought. I can give it up any time I like. The streets outside the patrician's palace were thronged. There was a manic air of carnival. Vimes ran a very practised eye over the assortment before him. It was the usual Ankh-Morpork mob in a time of crisis. Half of them were here to complain, a quarter of them were here to watch the other half, and the remainder were here to rob, importune, or sell hot dogs to the rest. There were a few new faces, though. There were a number of grim men with big swords slung over their shoulders and whips slung on their belts, striding through the crowds.
"News spreads quick, don't it?" observed a familiar voice by his ear. "Morning, Captain."
Vimes looked into the grinning, cadaverous face of cut-me-own-throat Dibbler, purveyor of absolutely anything that could be sold hurriedly from an open suitcase in a busy street, and was guaranteed to have fallen off the back of an ox-cart.
"Morning, throat," said Vimes absently. "What are you selling?"
"Genuine article, Captain."
Throat leaned closer. He was the sort of person who could make good morning sound like a once-in-a-lifetime, never-to-be-repeated offer. His eyes swivelled back and forth in their sockets like two rodents trying to find a way out.
"Can't afford to be without it," he hissed. "Anti-dragon cream. Personal guarantee, if you're incinerated, you get your money back. No quibble."
"What you're saying," said Vimes slowly, "if I understand the wording correctly, is that if I'm baked alive by a dragon, you'll return the money?"
"Upon personal application," said Cut Me Own Throat.
He unscrewed the lid from the jar of vivid green ointment and thrust it under Vimes's nose.
"Made from over 50 different rare spices and herbs to a recipe known only to a bunch of ancient monks what live on some mountain somewhere. $1 a jar, and I'm cutting my own throat. It's a public service, really," he added piously.
"You've got to hand it to those ancient monks brewing it up so quickly," said Vimes.
"Clever buggers," agreed Cut Me Own Throat. "It must be all that meditation and yap yogurt."
"So what's happening, Throat?" said Vimes. "Who are all these guys with big swords?"
"Dragon hunters, Captain. The patrician announced a reward of $50,000 to anyone who brings him the dragon's head. Not attached to the dragon either. He's no fool, that man."
"What?"
"That's what he said. It's written all over the posters."
$50,000?
"Not chicken feed, eh?"
"More like dragon fodder," said Vimes. "It'd bring trouble, you mark his words. I'm amazed you're not grabbing a sword and joining in."
"I am more in what you might call the service sector, Captain."
Throat looked both ways conspiratorially, and passed Vimes a slip of parchment. It said, "Anti-dragon mirror shields, 500 Ankh-Morpork dollars. Portable lair detectors, 250 Ankh-Morpork dollars. Dragon-piercing arrows, $100 per each. Shovels, $5. Picks, $5. Sacks, $1. Vimes handed it back.
"Why the sacks?" he said.
"On account of the hoard," said Throat.
"Oh, yes," said Vimes gloomily. "Of course."
"Tell you what," said Throat. "Tell you what, for our boys in brown, 10% off."
"And you're cutting your own throat, Throat?"
15% for officers," urged Throat, as Vimes walked away.
The cause of the slight panic in his voice was soon apparent. He had plenty of competition. The people of Ankh-Morpork were not by nature heroic, but were by nature salesmen. In the space of a few feet, Vimes could have bought any number of magical weapons, genuine certificate of authenticity with every one, a cloak of invisibility, a good touch, he thought, and he was really impressed by the way the stall owner was using a mirror with no glass in it, and, by way of lighter relief, dragon biscuits, balloons, and windmills on sticks. Copper bracelets guaranteed to bring relief from dragons were a nice thought. There seemed to be as many sacks and shovels about as there were swords. Gold. That was it. The hoard. Ha! $50,000. An officer of the watch earned $30 a month and had to pay to have his own dents beaten out. What he couldn't do with $50,000. Vimes thought about this for a while and then thought of the things he could do with $50,000. There were so many more of them for a start. He almost walked into a group of men clustered around a poster nailed to the wall. It declared, indeed, that the head of the dragon that had terrorised the city would be worth 50,000 Ankh-Morpork dollars to the brave hero that delivered it to the palace. One of the cluster who, from his size weaponry and the way that he was slowly tracing the lettering with his finger, Vimes decided, was a leading hero, and he was doing the reading for the others.
To her
Palaki, he concluded.
50,000, said one of them, reflectively rubbing his chin.
Cheap job, said the intellectual. Well below the rate. Should be half the kingdom and his daughter's hand in marriage.
Yeah, but he ain't the king. He's patrician.
Well, half his patrimony or whatever. What's his daughter like?
The assembled hunters didn't know.
He's not married, Vimes volunteered, and he hasn't got a daughter.
They turned and looked him up and down. He could see the disdain in their eyes. They probably got through dozens like him every day.
Not got a daughter, said one of them. Wants people to kill dragons and he hasn't got a daughter.
Vimes felt, in an odd way, that he ought to support the lord of the city.
He's got a little dog that he's very fond of, he said helpfully.
Bleeding disgusting, not even having a daughter, said one of the hunters.
What's $50,000 these days? You spend that much in nets.
That's right, said another. People think it's a fortune, but they don't reckon on, well, it's not pensionable.
Wear and tear on virgins,
noted a small fat hunter.
Yeah, and then there's... What?
My specialty is unicorns,
the hunter explained with an embarrassed smile.
Oh, right.
The first speaker looked like someone who'd always been dying to ask the question.
I thought they were rare these days.
You're right there. You don't see many unicorns either,
said the unicorn hunter. Vimes got the impression that, in his whole life, this was his only joke.
Yeah, well, times are hard, said the first speaker sharply.
Monsters are getting uppity too, said another. I heard where this guy, he killed this monster in this lake, no problem, stuck its arm up over the door. And you know what? Its mum come up and complained. Its actual mum came right down to the hall the next day and complained. Actually complained. That's the respect you get.
The females are always the worst, said another hunter gloomily. I knew this cross-eyed gorgon once. Oh, she was a terror. Kept turning her own nose to stone.
It's our asses on the line every time, said the intellectual. I mean, I wish I had a dollar for every horse I'd had eaten out from underneath me.
Right, $50,000, he can stuff it. Yeah.
Right, cheapskate.
Let's go and have a drink.
Right.
They nodded in righteous agreement and strode off towards the mended drum, except for the intellectual, who sidled uneasily back to Vimes.
What sort of dog? He said.
What?
Said Vimes.
I said, what sort of dog?
A small wire-haired terrier, I think, said Vimes.
The hunter thought about this for some time.
Nah, he said eventually, and hurried off after the others. He's got an art in Pseudopolis, I believe, Vimes called after him. There was no response.
The captain of the watch shrugged and carried on through the throng to the patrician's palace. Where the patrician was having a difficult lunchtime.
"Gentlemen," he snapped, "I really don't see what else there is to do."
The assembled civic leaders muttered among themselves.
"At times like this, it is traditional that a hero comes forth," said the president of the Guild of Assassins. "A dragon slayer. Where is he? That's what I want to know. Why aren't our schools turning out young people with the kind of skills society needs?"
$50,000 don't sound much, said the chairman of the Guild of Thieves.
It may not be much to you, my dear sir, but it is all the city can afford, said the patrician firmly.
If it doesn't afford any more than that, I don't think there'll be a city for long, said the thief.
And what about trade? Said the representative of the Guild of Merchants.
People aren't going to sail here with cargo of rare comestibles just to have it incinerated, are they?
Gentlemen, gentlemen,
the patrician raised his hands in a conciliatory fashion.
It seems to me, he went on, taking advantage of the brief pause, that what we have here is strictly magical phenomenon. I would like to hear from our learned friend on this point.
Hmm?
Someone nudged the Arch-Chancellor of Unseen University, who had nodded off.
Huh? What?
Said the wizard, startled into wakefulness.
We were wondering, said the patrician loudly, what you were intending to do about this dragon of yours.
The Arch-Chancellor was old, but a lifetime of survival in a world of competitive wizardry and the Byzantine politics of Unseen University meant that he could whip up a defence argument in a split second. You didn't remain Arch-Chancellor for long if you let that sort of ingenuous remark whiz past your ear.
My dragon?
He said. "It's well known that the great dragons are extinct," said the patrician brusquely. "And besides, their natural habitat was definitely rural. So it seems to me that this one must be
"With respect, Lord Veterinary," said the Arch-Chancellor, "it has often been claimed that dragons are extinct. But the current evidence, if I may make so bold, tends to cast a certain doubt on the theory. As to habitat, what we are seeing here is simply a change of behaviour pattern. Occasioned by the spread of urban areas into the countryside, which has led to many hitherto rural creatures to adopt, nay, in many cases to positively embrace, a more municipal mode of existence. And many of them thrive on the new opportunities thereby open to them. For example, foxes are always knocking over my dustbins."
He beamed. He'd managed to get all the way through it without actually needing to engage his brain.
"Are you saying," said the assassin slowly, "that what we've got here is the first civic dragon?"
"That's evolution for you," said the wizard happily. "It should do well, too," he added. "Plenty of nesting sites, and a more than adequate food supply."
Silence greeted this statement, until the merchant said,
"What exactly is it that they do eat?"
The thief shrugged. "I seem to recall stories about virgins chained to huge rocks," he volunteered.
"It'll starve around here, then," said the assassin. "We're on loom."
"They used to go round ravening," said the thief. "Dunno if that's any help."
"Anyway," said the leader of the merchants, "it seems to be your problem again, my lord."
5 minutes later, the patrician was striding the length of the oblong office, fuming.
"They were laughing at me," said the patrician. "I could tell."
"Did you suggest a working party?" said Once.
"Of course I did. It didn't do the trick this time. You know, I really am inclined to increase the reward money."
"I don't think that would work, my lord. Any proficient monster slayer knows the rate for the job."
"Ha! Half the kingdom," muttered the patrician.
"And your daughter's hand in marriage," said Once.
"I suppose an aunt isn't acceptable," the patrician said hopefully.
"Tradition demands a daughter, my lord."
The patrician nodded gloomily.
"Perhaps we can buy it off," he said. "Are dragons intelligent?"
"I believe the word traditionally is cunning, my lord," said Once. "I understand they have a liking for gold."
"Really? What do they spend it on?"
"They sleep on it, my lord."
"What? Do you mean in a mattress?"
"No, my lord, on it."
The patrician turned this fact over in his mind.
"Don't they find it rather knobbly?" he said.
"So I would imagine, sir. I don't suppose anybody has ever asked."
Can they talk?"
"They're apparently good at it, my lord."
"Ah, interesting."
The patrician was thinking, if it can talk, it can negotiate. If it can negotiate, then I have it by the small scales, or whatever it is they have.
"And they are said to be silver-tongued," said Once.
The patrician leaned back in his chair.
"Only silver," he said.
There was the sound of muted voices in the passageway outside, and Vimes was ushered in.
"Ah, captain," said the patrician. "What progress?"
"Sorry, my lord," said Vimes, as the rain dripped off his cape.
"Towards apprehending this dragon," said the patrician firmly.
"The wading bird," said Vimes.
"You know very well what I mean," said Veterinari sharply.
"Investigations are in hand," said Vimes automatically.
The patrician snorted.
"All you have to do is find its lair," he said. "Once you have the lair, you have the dragon. That's obvious. Half the city seems to be looking for it."
"If there's a lair," said Vimes.
Once looked up sharply.
"Why do you say that?"
"We are considering a number of possibilities," said Vimes woodenly.
"If it has no lair, where does it spend its days?" said the patrician.
"Inquiries are being pursued," said Vimes.
"Then pursue them and find the lair," said the patrician sourly.
"Yes, sir. Permission to leave, sir."
"Very well, but I shall expect progress by tonight, do you understand?"
Now why did I wonder if it has a lair? Vimes thought, as he stepped out into the daylight in the crowded square. Because it didn't look real, that's why. If it isn't real, it doesn't need to do anything we expect. How can it walk out of an alley it didn't go into? Once you've ruled out the impossible, then whatever is left, however improbable, must be the truth. The problem lay in working out what was impossible, of course. That was the trick, all right. There was also the curious incident of the orangutan in the night time. By day, the library buzzed with activity. Vimes moved through it diffidently. Strictly speaking, he could go anywhere in the city, but the university had always held that it fell under thaumaturgical law, and he felt it wouldn't be wise to make the kind of enemies where you were lucky to end up the same temperature, let alone the same shape. He found the librarian hunched over his desk. The ape gave him an expectant look.
"Haven't found it yet, sorry," said Vimes. "Inquiries are continuing, but there is a little help you can give me."
"Hook!"
"Well, this is a magical library, right? I mean, these books are sort of intelligent, isn't that so? So, I've been thinking, I bet, if I got in here at night, they'd soon kick up a fuss, because they don't know me. But if they did know me, they'd probably not mind. So whoever took the book would have to be a wizard, wouldn't they? Or someone who works for the university, at any rate."
The librarian glanced from side to side, then grasped Vimes's hand and led him into the seclusion of a couple of bookshelves. Only then did he nod his head.
"Someone they know." A shrug, and then another nod. "That's why you told us, is it?"
"Hook!"
"And not the university council?"
"Hook!"
"Any idea who it is?"
The librarian shrugged, a decidedly expressive gesture for a body which was basically a sack between a pair of shoulder blades.
"Well, it's something. Let me know if any other strange things happen, won't you?"
Vimes looked up at the banks of shells.
"Stranger than usual, I mean."
"Hook!"
"Thank you. It's a pleasure to meet a citizen who regards it as their duty to assist the watch."
The librarian gave him a banana.